When Mike first asked me to come, I did have a lot of trepidation. It's not an area that I customarily address, and I felt a little bit like Daniel walking into the lion's den, albeit a group of very gentle, kind lions, as I'm sure the Eastern rituals have taught. And I'm not really here as an expert in meditation, certainly, not in ecstasy, either the medicinal or the non-medicinal variety. But I do want to share with you a few Judaic perspectives that I think that hopefully you can integrate into the totality of your explorations. First, I think that any sincere person would have to greatly admire anyone that is engaged in a spiritual search. You know, it's a funny thing that sometimes we talk about God, and this is what the Jews like to do, and they should do, and I sometimes get the response, well, God is what Christians do. Jews don't talk about God. Jews are not a spiritual people. And that is a tremendous, tremendous travesty and injustice to thousands of years of Judaism and generations of Jews. And if it is true that so many have sought spiritual fulfillment in other traditions, it's precisely because the message that they get from their parents is Judaism involves giving to the UJA, which is important, and supporting Israel, which is important. And that's it. No, God has nothing to do with it. And yet, Judaism is, in fact, an Eastern religion. Judaism's origin is in the East. And basically, there's a lot of commonality between the great spiritual traditions. And in fact, as King David says in Psalms, he says, I am a friend and I am a companion to all who seek you, God. And we join up together, we try to establish points of contact. In fact, without being too chauvinistic, the Zohar makes the claim that the origin of Eastern religions is in fact from Abraham. There's a reference in the book of Genesis to after Sarah died, Abraham took a concubine whose name was Keturah, and he had a number of children from Keturah, and it mentions he sent them to the East. He gave them gifts, and he sent them to the East. And there's a rabbinic tradition that says that the gifts involve certain philosophies and mystical understandings of life, and the Zohar actually makes the claim that the various philosophies in India, China, the Orient, etc., did have their origin in the Abrahamic heritage. So in fact, we Jews like to claim we're the first of everything. We even make the claim that we had a connection in that as well. Certainly, over the past 150 years, primarily since the Enlightenment, the aftermath of the French Revolution, Judaism has progressively become a more rationalistic religion. The mystical elements, the spiritual elements, have tended to be covered up. This is certainly the case for those who are not adherents to halakha, but even within the halakhic community where the external rituals have been kept and are kept, but often they have been robbed of their inner meaning and their potency. They've often been, as it were, separated from their spiritual roots. And as a result, for many people, not all, but for many people, they have become, to some degree, an empty shell. And once again, this is a tragedy. There are a lot of historical reasons why over the past century and a half, Judaism has been suspicious, at least in its organized way, of the mystical and spiritual. Part of it is because we've been burnt a few times. We've had the false messiahs, Shabbat Zvi, you may have read, and there were various other breakaway movements, and there was kind of a fear that we needed to circle the wagons and keep out all of these things, which resulted in breakaways and deviations and the like. There was also a notion that as the world itself generally became more removed from mystical and spiritual experience and became more rationalistic and scientific, the Jews would be a laughing stock if we would hold on to some of those old beliefs that had such power. As understandable as this is, however, it was not without a cost. That is, Judaism, which is nourished and is generated from deep spiritual and mystical impulses, has become separated. What we have found is, however, that we know that Judaism has always had a very deep mystical and spiritual tradition, largely in Kabbalah. It is maintained by many, many groups of Hasidim, and even in mainstream Judaism, sensitive spiritual leaders draw upon this, they try to communicate this. And I think it's very important that Jewish people know that a source of this wisdom exists, a source of this wisdom offering profound insight into the meaning of life, into the purpose of existence, into the use of ritual, not as a mechanical end in itself, but as a way of drawing closer to God and becoming part of universal reality. These are not things that were invented by Tibetan monks or Buddhism or Confucianism, although the ideas are there too. But these are ideas that you can find within the Jewish tradition. And it may take a little bit of looking. I will say that the one thing that perhaps Tibetan Buddhism, at least, again, I've looked at the Jewel of the Lotus, that's where I get my knowledge base from. But the one thing that I will give perhaps the Dalai Lama credit for is the attempt to make this body of knowledge and this basis of understanding more accessible to a larger public. That has not been the agenda of the Jewish community. In fact, in the Jewish tradition, there has been a great reluctance to expose this so-called secret knowledge to the outsider. In fact, we even have teachings that says one should not study the Kabbalah until one is at least 40 years old, and one is married, and one has mastered the language, one has filled one's stomach with the Talmud and the Poskim, which are called the revealed law, and only then is one ready to enter the secrets. And this is not done in large classes, it's done very individual, tutelage, one-to-one. And of course, it's very notable, by the way, we talk about 40 as being the age of understanding, it's very notable that the greatest Kabbalists tended to die before the age of 40. Of course, as Moshe Weldock's remark, that just proves the point, perhaps, that until you're 40, better not to get involved. But the Ari, the Holy Lion, the greatest of the Kabbalists, who died at the age of 38, Rav Moshe Kardavero, who perhaps is the second in eminence, died at 48. Ari Kaplan, who is an outstanding modern scholar of Kabbalah, died tragically at 48, leaving a family of 10 children. So there is something here. We're dealing with powerful stuff, at least that's at the deeper levels. And when there's powerful stuff, one needs a master to which one can be initiated. However, keep in mind that there are levels and there are levels. While the ultimate levels might be a bit too powerful for the average person to take, this shouldn't be approached on an all-or-nothing basis. There is knowledge and there is insight and there is spirituality that can be accessible to people at different levels. Just because one is not yet equipped spiritually to become an ultimate master of the subject should not preclude the notion that none of it can be made available. There are many, many fine books. Many were written by Rabbi Kaplan himself. I can mention Meditation itself. Rabbi Kaplan wrote a series of 3 volumes, which is available in books. Volume 1 was Meditation and the Bible. Volume 2 is Meditation and the Kabbalah. And Volume 3 is a general primer on Jewish meditation, trying to incorporate various techniques. And this is something that I would urge all of you to look at. Even something like davening, prayers, right? Orthodox Jews pray 3 times a day. Now, prayer, to the extent it's regarded as normal communication, might get boring after a while. You're saying the same words 3 times a day. But for those of you who are students of meditation, know that in terms of a mantra effect, it can have exactly the opposite. And Rabbi Kaplan articulates a whole approach to prayer in which prayer itself can become a meditative exercise. And it's very, very clear that this was not an invention of Rabbi Kaplan, but if you go, for example, back to the Talmud, which was written thousands of years ago, we are told that there were Hasidim or Rishonim, the early pious people. This is not the Hasidic movement, it was much later, but pious people, they used to spend 9 hours a day in prayer. How did that work? They would prepare themselves 1 hour before they would begin their prayers. They would pray for 1 hour, and then they would decompress, re-enter the world with 1 hour. That was done 3 times a day. Now, prayer always refers to the Amidah, the 18 benedictions. Now, the 18 benedictions comprise approximately 3,000 words. If you have to say 3,000 words over 60 minutes, then essentially one is stretching out the words at an average of 7 seconds per word. At that point, therefore, what one is really doing is, one is not merely communicating a word on a literal level, but one is trying to enter the holiness of the letters, and one is trying to make a connection going beyond the literal meaning. But essentially, the Amidah should be a meditation, the idea of Kavanah, which we often interpret as understanding what you're doing. But Kavanah literally means directed, focused thoughts. And if you look at Rabbi Kaplan's books, and actually there are a number of other authors who have written on the subject, who are within Halachic Judaism, I want to emphasize, they stress the notions of meditation, even incorporating breathing exercises, meditating on letters, meditating on objects, meditating, visualizing the name of God, particularly the 4-letter name of God, the Tetragrammaton, in front of one's eyes, as a way of being inspired with reverence and holiness. So these techniques, these mechanisms, these visualizations are all part of the Jewish tradition. Perhaps they have been suppressed, but one should certainly not feel that one cannot be a legitimate Jew if one practices these things, because these are part of the Jewish tradition. There are books, there are manuals, many of them have not been printed. Rabbi Kaplan, in fact, particularly in the volume Meditation on the Kabbalah, He actually translates excerpts from Kabbalistic books which have never been published. They have been suppressed, but certainly they're part of the tradition. So again, these are certainly things that are part of our Jewishness that we should embrace. And once again, we should talk about Judaism being a religion of God consciousness, a sense of being almost enamored with God. There's a reference to love sickness, wanting to embrace the divine, like a moth that is drawn to a candle, or like a candle that becomes part of a greater flame. All of this. We know that one of the most powerful Kabbalistic imageries that the Ari developed was the concept of the breaking of the vessels and the scattering of the sparks. I'm sure you have heard this, and that the concept is that when God created the world and filled the universe with his light, the universe, which is a vessel that contains the divine light, was too fragile to contain the light, and therefore there was a bursting and an explosion, and there are sparks of holiness all over the place. And the job of a human being is to extract the spark of holiness from wherever it may be. So there could be holiness everywhere. There could be holiness even in the midst of evil. And without, again, so I'm not going to talk about the Holocaust in any great detail, but within the death and destruction and degradation of the Holocaust, there were isolated pockets of holiness. There were sparks. There were righteous Gentiles who gave their life to save the Jews. There were people in concentration camps, as Viktor Frankl tells us, who demonstrated the highest levels of saintly nobility and compassion precisely in the crucible of hell. And indeed, part of the approach to evil is that no evil could exist unless there would be some goodness within it that gives it life. And it's our job to extract that goodness. So too, when we look at the world and we see even non-Jewish forms of worship, we can acknowledge as Jews that there are sparks of holiness and insight everywhere in the world. And my only plea to you as a special pleader is, by all means, extract those sparks of holiness, but bring it back with you into the Jewish tradition and recognize that within Judaism, not only is there room for it, but it's something that we need. We need spirituality. We need to be energized. We need to go back to what Judaism in fact is. And I'm not even talking about creating a new Judaism. I'm talking about simply restoring what authentically Judaism in fact is and what unfortunately it has tended to move away from. The tremendous great energizer. Rabbinic Judaism, which of course is the edifice of halacha, is the structure, but the foundation that gives meaning to that structure lies in a return to the spiritual roots of closeness to God and ecstasy, which is expressed in prayer and in ritual and in the study of the Torah. And therefore, gather the sparks and bring them back so we could truly merit this ultimate redemption, both on the individual level and on the collective level that all of us seek. As Mike mentions, there is, of course, always a concern about Avodah Zarah. We know idol worship. Idol worship is a real bad thing. God warns us many, many times about not worshiping the sun or the moon or any particular image. We know that if you read the Book of Kings, you know, whenever the Jews worship idols, they tend to get in trouble. You know, there's galut, there's destruction in the temple, and God's wrath is poured upon us. And there is, of course, a major concern that rabbis and other committed Jews often raise as to whether we are dealing with idol worship, because on an external level, there are some of the rituals involved in Eastern religion, which do involve some type of prostration or some type of worship of images themselves. Needless to say, of course, a lot of our uncertainties is because not all of us do have a fundamental understanding of what these worship rites are, and the understandable reaction of anyone, including myself, when we don't fully understand a phenomenon is to say, until we understand, we can't let things in. Because it might be Avodah Zarah. Maybe it isn't, maybe it is. But if you don't know, you have to err on the side of strictness. And that's certainly a legitimate approach. But let me just talk a little bit about idolatry and what is idolatry in the Jewish tradition. And then hopefully you can make your judgments as to what is appropriate Jewishly for you to incorporate and what is not. Certainly any statement that meditation per se is idolatrous, I think, would have to be condemned as false, just coming from misunderstanding. Meditation in terms of mantra, or in terms of reaching a higher consciousness, in terms of focusing your mind, or in terms of relieving stress, is not inherently a kosher or a treif activity. It's a beneficial, useful activity, but I wouldn't automatically It can lead to spiritual revelation, but I wouldn't automatically construe it as either godly or idolatrous. So that's not the issue. Let me just mention an interesting point that the Talmud makes about idolatry. The Talmud records that at the beginning of the Second Temple era, when the Jews finally came back to Israel after the 70 years of exile in Babylon, Ezra, who was the leader of the Jewish people, said that, gee, the impulse towards idolatry is so strong in the human being, and it creates such difficulties, let us pray to God that he abolish from our hearts the impulse of idolatry, which is very extraordinary, because God doesn't interfere with free will. But this was too hard of a choice. So it's mentioned that Ezra and the men of the Great Assembly fasted for 3 days and three nights, and then God took away the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination for idolatry, which is why most of us don't have the urge to bow down at the nearest statue. We once had that Yetzer Hara, it was taken away. So then Ezra said the following, gee, that's pretty good. If we lost the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah, and that was successful, Ezra didn't even think he would get that one, let's pray that God takes away the Yetzer Hara for sexual promiscuity. You know, that's the other big one, right? Adultery and everything else. So they fasted 3 days, and they waited too. But what happened was, you know, people stopped getting married, and no one had any kids, and the chicken stopped laying eggs and everything. So Ezra figured, you know, we really need that one. Let's bring that Yetzer Hara back. But the Yetzer Hara for idolatry was taken away from us. And Talmud explained that's why we don't have the same idea of worshiping idols as we used to have. But there's a comment from the Vilna Gaon, and the Vilna Gaon remarks that nature abhors a vacuum. And if God took away one impulse from our hearts, it had to have been replaced by another impulse. And he says, the Yetzer Hara of idolatry today has now become the Yetzer Hara for money and materialism. And that's a very interesting point, because what it says is two things. If you go back to the bad old days when they used to do clumsy lobotomies back in the 50s, like in a monkey over a cuckoo's nest, you saw that if somebody, as it were, was mentally deranged or had rages, they would just cut out, you know, a quarter of his brain, and that stopped the rages. But something was taken out in the process. Certain creativities, ability to feel. And what the Vilna Gaon is teaching us is that, yes, idolatry was a bad thing, and it had to be excised from our consciousnesses, but it had a real cost. Because as Maimonides tells us, the passion towards idolatry is a fiery passion to link up with God in an accessible manner. It's very hard for a human being to link up with a God which is beyond body, beyond shape. In fact, the great image, the great lure of Christianity is the personification of the divine. The idea, in fact, a beautiful idea on one level, that God, as it were, can have a son, and God's son can die, and, you know, God knows what we're going through because God's gone through it. I mean, that's the great, I use myth in the religious sense, not in the pejorative sense, that's the great myth of Christianity, is the personification of God. And Maimonides tells us the origin of idolatry is the psychological need of a human being to feel close to God by giving God some type of tangible representation. It's understandable, and it comes from a holy place, but it's distorted and it's incorrect. Just because it fills a human need does not make it legitimate, and therefore it's incorrect. And what the Vilna Gaon is telling us is, God saw we felt too much, and he took away some of that passion. And now it's become directed into the gross, coarse, material world. So what the Rambam is telling us is that God did a lobotomy on us, by and large. And that is, we no longer have the passion for idolatry. That's because we no longer have the passion for God. And it's become transmuted into money, into possessions. And in fact, the Talmud makes it very, very clear that there are many modern forms of idolatry that we still have. We no longer bow before the idol. The Talmud says anger is idolatry. The Talmud says jealousy is idolatry. The Talmud says, as the Vilna Gaon quotes, materialism, over-connection to this world, is idolatry. And that, perhaps, I would suggest, is the greater Avodah Zarah that we have to combat. Because the traditional biblical Avodah Zarah, the Talmud tells us, we no longer have that tremendous desire. That was taken away from us. To some degree, I fear that the attractions, you know, it's almost like, I remember reading a novel recently about, I think it was the Reader's Digest condensed book, or just kind of bathroom meeting type stuff, but a story about somebody was admitted to a medical school, and they kind of rigged up the beds to give all the people a subconscious message about against socialized medicine and everything. But one woman got in by accident, and for some reason she couldn't be brainwashed. It was a mistake. They weren't supposed to admit her because they give these pre-screening tests, but it didn't work in her case. So I fear that Jews who are attracted to Eastern religions maybe didn't have all about it. Meaning to say, their passion for godliness is still there. They kind of escaped that test. And therefore, it's coming from a tremendously high and elevated place. It's coming from the desire not to live a world of empty futility and material acquisition and rat races and who has the bigger house or the bigger car. It's coming authentically to this desire to be close to God. But it's dangerous. It's dangerous because it can indeed lead to the idolatry. Idolatry in its original pristine sense. So, in a way, the Jubus, as Roger Kamenetz calls them, the Jewish Buddhists, are dangerous people. They are vestigial people. They are what the Jews were like thousands of years ago, before Ezra acted. And they somehow escaped the Labanim. That means there's tremendous potential there. There's tremendous holiness. But when there's tremendous holiness, there's also tremendous danger. Ecclesiastes tells us, good and evil are always equally balanced. When there's powerful feelings in one direction, there will be powerful feelings in the other direction. Most of us live muted lives, so the potential for evil isn't so great, and neither is the potential for good. We're kind of like, you know, in the middle. So we're not too dangerous either way we go. But for some, there's a tremendous danger which you can fear either way. Therefore, this is indeed a road that can be extremely valuable, extremely deep, extremely deep. But you have to proceed with caution here, because some elements Judaism would embrace, some elements might fall within the idolatry right there. You know, it was mentioned that in a way, the Hasidic literature interprets that this was the story of Nadav and Avihu. You may recall Nadav and Avihu were the two children of the high priest, that when the tabernacle was consecrated, they brought a foreign fire to the tabernacle of God. God destroyed them. And what this foreign fire is not really well defined. It's one of those passages where the Chumash seems to be alluding to something, but it doesn't quite say what's going on. And in the rabbinic tradition, they offer a lot of things. None of them ever didn't want to marry. They wanted to achieve a state of holiness through celibacy. Or according to another interpretation, they used wine or alcohol, hallucinogenic substances, as it were, to reach a level of holiness. And all of this is called the foreign fire, because it came from a passion within, but it was not subject to God's law. And as a result, it resulted in their own destruction. Not because they were lowly, but precisely because they were so spiritually sensitive that there was a special danger in going beyond this. You know, there's a story, and I was very unhappy to see originally in the schedule, I believe there was going to be a session on stories and therapeutic value. I didn't believe that wasn't scheduled. But you know that in the Hasidic tradition in particular, stories play a very, very important part. Parables, stories. Perhaps the greatest practitioner of them was Rav Nachman Breslov, the Breslover Rebbe, who died 200 years ago. And he never had a successor. To this day, the Breslover Hasidim, which is still a vibrant, though small movement, regards Rav Nachman as the Rebbe. They have various people who are, you know, kind of acting Rebbe, but Rav Nachman is the Rebbe. They're called the Dead Hasidim for this reason. And Rav Nachman taught, towards the end of his life, many of his teachings were taught by story. And someone asked him, why don't you just say what you mean? Why do you teach by story? He said, well, you know, if I give my teachings, some people may like them, some people may not like them, some people may understand them, some people don't understand them. If I teach by a story, so either they'll understand me or they'll hear a good story. So either way, you know, what are you going to complain? You don't like the story? You know, that's not, he said that wouldn't be a problem. So one of Rav Nachman's famous stories, which I see now is not in children's books, although not in Rav Nachman's name, is about the person who dreamt that if he would travel, a little Polish Jew and a little shtetl, dreamed that if he would travel to Vienna and dig under a bridge, he would find a tremendous treasure. And, you know, he ignored the dream, but he kept on having the dream over and over again. And eventually he took the long trek to Vienna on foot, and he began digging, and he had to dig in the middle of the night because there were guards around. And And finally, you know, after many months, he gets caught by a guard. The guard accuses him of being a spy. And the Jew is really very afraid. He says, "No, I'm just here because I had a dream that if I traveled 2,000 miles, I would find my treasure." And the soldier laughs at him and says, "You know, you're a fool. You think dreams mean anything? I had a dream that if I travel 2,000 miles to this poor Jew's house in Poland and dig under the bed, I'm going to find the treasure. You think I listened to that?" And of course, it was that Jew's bed. So he goes all the way back home. He digs under his bed, and there's this treasure that was there all the time. Now, Rav Nachman, of course, does not give us the moral of the story, and you have to figure out your own moral. But at least one meaning is fairly apparent. That Rav Nachman says, all of us in life are engaged in a journey, and we're engaged in a search. And very often, we feel we have to be in a different situation. Different religion, different culture, different job, different community, different parents, different environments. And that is where I will find perfection. Rav Nachman is teaching us that the ability of holiness and the ability to achieve a relationship with God is exactly where you are. It is within us. It is where we are. We may have to travel many, many thousands of miles, both geographically and spiritually, to come to that realization. But ultimately, there is a treasure within us. As Rav Nachman is saying, you may have to go to the Rebbe, you may have to go to the teacher, whoever that may be, to discover that. But there is a treasure within that a person must tap into. And, you know, how ironic it is if a person lives their lives always wishing they were something else, somewhere else, someplace else, and then you never become what you really were intended to be. You never became the person. Rav Zusha, another great Hasidic Rebbe, again, it's a famous remark, said that when he goes to heaven, God is not going to ask him, why couldn't he be like Abraham? Because he wasn't Abraham. Why couldn't he be a Moses? Why couldn't he be a Zusha? Why wasn't he what he was? That indeed is the ultimate indictment, the ultimate challenge that we as human beings have to have. You know, they tell us, again, my brief here basically is that I think there's much, much valuable, good things that one can learn and absorb from all the traditions. But I hope you'll bring it back into Judaism and see what Judaism says as well. It can only enrich the Jewish experience. They tell a story about a man in Europe who wanted to be an Apikoros. An Apikoros is a heretic. So he was told, if you want to be an Apikoros, you got to register with the head heretic in Minsk. Yaakov is the head heretic. So he goes to Minsk, you know, in Russia, and he sees Yaakov, a man with a long white beard, who's sitting in front of the Talmud, you know, sitting and learning, wearing tefillin. So he says, "Excuse me, I heard you're a heretic, you're an Apikoros." He says, "Oh yes, I'm a heretic. Do you want to become a heretic too?" He says, "Yes, yes, I am a non-believer." So Yaakov told him, "Well, certainly you've studied the entire Babylonian Talmud." He says, "Well, no, not really." He says, "Well, at least the Mishnah." He says, "No." "Well, do you know Chumash and Rashi?" He says, "No, I'm a heretic, I don't believe in this." So he says, "You're no heretic, you're just ignorant." And again, I don't mean any disrespect. I'm just suggesting that when a person is at the beginning, I can quote no less an authority than the Dalai Lama himself, where he says, when a person decides in life what to accept and what to reject, a person must start off with where they are. Because where they are is presumably part of God's plan, which is where they should attempt to seek spiritual fulfillment. And then we enlarge our circle, and then we incorporate whatever we can incorporate that we find useful and helpful. But you have to start where you are, because ultimately, as Rav Nachman's story teaches us, the treasure is within ourselves. And that's kind of a major lesson. And then we reject, we are adults, we accept, we reject, whatever it is, as it were. But you reject when you know. But you have to initially explore. And as long as one is open to the exploration, Judaism, I think, respects people who sincerely look for God, try to find God in a way that they best understand. Having said that, let me just point out, we've been stressing kind of the common features that Judaism might share with other traditions. Let me just stress perhaps some of the unique aspects of Judaism, which I think may have to be superimposed on these other aspects. And that is, Judaism very much believes, number one, in the sanctification of the material worlds. Meaning, unlike some traditions that would teach an ultimate goal of renunciation, of separation, of repudiation of the material, Judaism does not necessarily teach everything is holy, but it does teach that everything can be utilized as an instrument of holiness to become close to God. For example, just like one example, the notion of being celibate has never entered the Jewish tradition. In fact, the very first commandment in the Torah is to be fruitful and multiply, to have families. The sex act itself is considered to be, when it's conducted in marriage and under the proper conditions, is considered to be an act of godliness, an act of creation. It was reserved for the holiest night of the week, which was Friday night, was the traditional time. The mitzvot that involve eating rituals and various other things are designed to teach us that even the animalistic portions of existence, in other words, those parts of our lives that we share in common with the animal, can be elevated into acts of godliness and creation. And particularly in the Kabbalah, we see the notion of every little act that a person does is invested with cosmic significance. So the dichotomy between the physical and the spiritual is something that is very, very foreign to Judaism. Now again, Judaism is not a monolithic belief system. You can certainly find quotations in various sources that talk about asceticism, that talk about separation, that talk about disengagement, although you will not find things on celibacy, I'll have to emphasize that. You'll be very hard-pressed to find that, but you'll find other types of renunciation. So I'm not going to deny that they do exist. But by and large, they are not part of the mainstream, and they're not part even of the mainstream mystical tradition of Judaism, which stresses the idea that if God's creation is ketov, right, in Genesis it says, what God made is good, how can one turn one back? In fact, there's even a statement, don't tell your kids this, the Jerusalem Talmud says that a person, when he dies, will have to give an account to God for all the pleasures of the world that they could have enjoyed that they did not. So if your kids want to go to the movies, you know, they say, you know, Mom and Dad, you know, God says I'm supposed to enjoy these legitimate pleasures. So there is a sense of a joy in life, and there's a sense that even the material can be sanctified. In fact, even the Brit Milah, the Zohar tells us, the reason the circumcision is, the male circumcision is on the penis, on the male organ, is precisely because that is the most involuntary, that is the most material, that is the most removed from the mental and cognitive faculties of man, and yet even that can be sanctified and elevated into the service of God. And therefore, Judaism says we live in the worlds and we don't try to escape it. And here is where I think, again, I certainly cannot speak as an expert on anything other than Judaism, I'm barely on that, but I think here we have to emphasize that sometimes, at least among some practices and in some rites, there's a certain sense of self-absorption, where a person reaches meditative states, and a person is disengaged from the world, and a person reaches the highest levels of a nirvana or whatever it is. But the Jew asks a question, the Jew's always asked a question. The Jew says, what happens after I'm there? What happens? What's exactly the purpose? Is the purpose to feel good? Is the purpose to get rid of my stress? Is the purpose just to feel close to God? Judaism very much teaches that whatever we achieve, then have to bring down with us. We have to make the world a better place. Judaism very much stresses building communities, building families, transmission to families. The Passover Seder, of course, as you know, its primary structure is the communication of the truths of Judaism in an intergenerational way. So it's not enough to reach the highest levels, to go to the top of the mountain. You have to come down from the mountain and bring some of that holiness, some of that goodness here. And therefore, Judaism stresses above all the sanctity of relationships, not only sexual, but the idea of relationship, of loving another human being. Because only when you love another human being by acts of love and compassion and benevolence do you truly love God. And you can't achieve that love of God in isolation. It is only in collective communal interaction that God can be found. And here, I think perhaps the best source for that idea is songs. A Song of Songs, as you know, is written in the form of erotic poetry. A man seeking after his beloved, and a woman looking for a man, etc. And yet the Talmud teaches us very clearly that Song of Songs is a metaphor for the passionate love that God has for the Jewish people. God is the male, the Jewish people as female, etc., and all of those near misses that the book details. That's about when God is not, when the man is knocking at the door, the woman says, "I'm going to sleep." When she finally gets up, the man is not there anymore. Rabbi Akiva tells us this is a metaphor for messianic yearnings, that when God is ready to redeem us, you know, we've gone to sleep. When we're ready, God says it's not time, right? The poignancy of those encounters. But the question is this: if in fact the Song of Songs is metaphorical, then why didn't God write it the way he wanted? In other words, why doesn't God write directly about the love he has for the Jewish people? Why is it masked in the man-woman metaphor? But the answer is very simple. Because a metaphor is not merely a substitute, but the metaphor reflects the underlying reality of the message. That is, in truth, the passion that God has for us and we have for God must be mirrored in the intimacy of human relationships as we experience them. One who is incapable of loving another human being, one who does not understand the literal meaning of the Song of Songs, is not going to understand the figurative meaning. I mentioned in my show this thought a number of times. I quote Leo Tolstoy. Leo Tolstoy, at the end of his life, was an avid social reformer. Perhaps you know he wrote anti-smoking tracts even, and he wrote a book calling for the abolition of serfdom. This is in the waning years of Tsarist Russia. And he was once criticized by a colleague who said, you know, Count Tolstoy, you write against serfdom and you treat your serfs not very well. And Thomas Jefferson had slaves, right? You know, you don't treat your serfs well. So he said, well, I am a lover of humanity, but I don't get along with people. And the occupational hazard here is that human beings are attracted to globalisms. We are attracted to loving humanity, world peace, etc. Then we go out and we kick the dog, or we yell at our wife, or whatever it is. Judaism says that's not how you do it. You start with the immediate interpersonal situation. Learn to love another person. Learn to see the godliness that is within them, because ultimately, all human beings are in the image of God. And the truth of the matter is, the true analysis of human love is all human love is love of the divine. Now that's not idolatry, but rather that rests on the fact that when one loves another person, as opposed to simply being physically attracted, one loves those qualities that are uniquely divine, whether it be their humor, their kindness, their intelligence, their perception, their empathy, whatever it is you love about somebody. It goes beyond the physical, is because of the divine qualities within them. So you are loving God to the degree you love godliness within the other human being. And this, I will not say that, you know, this is exclusive to Judaism, but I think this is an aspect which Judaism, I think, may emphasize over alternative systems. The notion of finding God in the context of human interaction, human relationships, of living in the world rather than trying to escape from the world. Recognizing that God is found not in black and white, but God is found in gray. And it's precisely in the struggles of trying to get through your life that one will find the light of God. Let me just end with a Hasidic thought that brings this out very beautifully. If you remember the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and it describes there the concept that there was thunder and lightning. Before God gave the Ten Commandments, there was thunder and there was then God gave the Ten Commandments. And right after that point, instead of lightning, it talks about they perceived torches. It actually mentions they heard thunder and lightning. I'm sorry, it says they saw thunder and lightning. That itself is very interesting because that implies one can see sounds, which is a phenomenon also in various schools of meditation in which the senses can get crossed over. But that's not the point I'm going to talk about now, but the point that I want to emphasize is that it started off talking about lightning and it switched to a torch. Visualization of lightning versus the visualization of the torch. And Rav Tzedek of Lublin, again one of the great Hasidic masters of this century, taught that the difference in visualization was a metaphor for a transformation that the Jewish people underwent as a result of the Torah. Before the Torah was given to the Jewish people, holiness was lightning. Lightning was brilliant flashes of lights, the ecstatic experience of the divine. But ultimately, you're plunged into darkness because holiness could be achieved only by disengagement from the world, separation from the world. Separation may give you real highs, but invariably you have to eat, you have to sleep, you have to go down from the mountain. So it's not going to be permanent. The Torah created a way of life where even our physical material existence can be endowed with sanctity. That's no longer a lightning flash. It's not going to be as exciting. It's not going to be as ecstatic. But it gives us a warmth and a guidance and a direction that can stay with us even during the hard times. You know, a religion has to be a very durable good. A religion has to sustain a person when they don't feel that spiritual. A religion has to sustain a person when they have to clean up the mess that their kids made, or that they made, or whatever the case may be. It has to be a situation where you can have that connection to God, even if you're not at your spiritual highest fitness level. As Tucker says, that is not necessarily the holiness of the lightning, which is the brilliant flash of light that is punctuated into darkness. But that is the slow, steady, flickering torch that keeps you going, even when times are not going to be that easy. So these are kind of some of the unique ideas that Judaism brings to this mix. Again, I do want to express my very, very deep admiration for people who are spiritual searchers. This is a rare commodity today. And as King David said in the Psalms, Karov Hashem l'chol karov, God is near to all who call to him. Chol asher yikru be'emetz, as long as you call to him in truth and in honesty. And I wish you all much, much success and luck in a very difficult and rewarding search that you're embarked on. Thank you very much.